Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Something is afoot in America, and it has been, I guess, since the founding of this country, but something has happened, and of course we're talking about race, and something has happened, though, since President Barack Obama entered the White House, even in before that, during the course of this race-ward presidency. And since that time, there's been a bubbling up from the surface. There's been more and more tension going on in this country. The question is, what's going on here? How have people responded to it on all sides of the cards in our country? And I have a lot to say share about that with you, but I think it's all complex and tied into not just Ms. Shirley Sherrod's case, who was fired on a doctored video. And it makes me think of the doctored video that happened with Acorn, that shut Acorn down. She left her job and was fired from her job, has been offered her job back this afternoon. And as I said earlier, she has not decided whether or not she wants to return to that position because she thought they took too long to get back to her and to apologize in the correct way. But it's beyond that. This has wrapped around what's going on with the Tea Party and NAACP and Glenn Beck's returning honor rally that's being held on the same days as Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom Now and the 47th anniversary on the same place at the same time. And all that feeds into it. Something is afoot in America. So we are joined here by Sherrilyn Ifill, who joined us for the first part of this program, is going to lay out her thoughts that she and I talked about this morning that I know she's been writing about. She's a civil rights lawyer and professor of law at the University of Maryland and a contributor to TheRoot.com. We're also joined in studio by Stacey Peterson. Dr. Stacey Peterson is professor of communication arts at the College of Notre Dame here in Maryland. Dr. Lester Spence is professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. Abigail Thunstrom joins us by phone. She was vice chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and is adjunct scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Good to be here.
And the lines are open here at 410-319-8888 for you to join in on this conversation or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Now, Sherrilyn, since we know we only have Abigail, I know we only have you for the first half hour or so of the show. I want to come right to you so you're part of this conversation, but Sherrilyn, I would like you to please kind of lay out your ideas and thoughts that you shared with me this morning that I thought were so interesting and it would be a good way to stimulate and begin this conversation.
Well, of course, and thank you, Mark, for having me on. The Shirley Sherrod story is, keeps unfolding up to the minute. I don't think she's been offered the job back.
Yes. She has. She was offered a job. It was the Washington Post put out a news alert at 4:45.
Okay.
And
okay,
she's been, that. Yeah.
I'm hoping, and this is what I said to you earlier today, and I actually believe that this can be a wake-up call because, this, what happened to Shirley Sherrod is in many ways a mess, and one of the things I would really encourage listeners to do is to go on the NAACP website and listen to her entire speech, which I actually think is a very important speech for those of us who are interested in thinking about race and racism and the possibilities of redemption in this country. Because what Shirley Sherrod did in that speech was really talk about her life and describe her life as a young girl in the South whose father was murdered by white men who were acquitted, even though there were three eyewitnesses to the murder, and about the result of that, which was really her vow to commit her life to public service. She talks about the kind of violence that was visited on her family even after her father's death and her mother's protection of her home. And she talks about her life then working on land issues. And the story she tells is so important, very powerful. But what happens to her, of course, we all know, is that the videotape gets cut and pasted. And it turns into a calling card for those who have been really pushing this whole a trope of reverse racism. And reverse racism, of course, the idea of it has its beginnings in the organized resistance to affirmative action, which really gains in strength in the 1970s with the Bakke case and has continued on through today. And we saw it certainly on display last summer in the tableau that was laid out with the nomination of Justice Sotomayor to the Supreme Court, where she also was branded as a reverse racist. And the theory, the story of reverse racism is that there are entitled, elite, or conversely unqualified blacks who are taking things away from hardworking, average, qualified whites. And so the juxtaposition of Sonia Sotomayor and firefighter Frank Ricci was part of that story. And there are people now, I mean, there are parts of this story that are actually important to explore, the whole question of how do we deal with affirmative action, what does it mean, where do we place, and what is the significance of the stories of whites who feel themselves to have been harmed by affirmative action in the workplace, like Frank Ricci. But that's really different than what we've seen happening in the last year and a half since Obama has gotten elected, when there are those who have been trading in this term, in this reverse racism idea, to evoke this idea of Obama and his fellow travelers as people who have come to take over, to take away from deserving whites. And Shirley Sherrod fit into that story once you cut and pasted her videotape. And so it was used to exploit. My belief, Mark, is that this is really the last gasp of a certain kind of white supremacist thinking. It doesn't mean that there's not tremendous harm that won't be done in the midst of that gasp if we don't wake up. And that's why I'm hoping this is a wake-up call. A wake-up call, I think, to the White House, to the NAACP, to those of us on the right and the left who are responsible, that we really have to take a moment and breathe deeply before we run off half-cocked on some of these charges, particularly when they're peddled by those who have shown their interest in using this idea of reverse racism for divisiveness and to turn us back and to try and distract from particularly what this administration is trying to do. And I think that this has been such a mess, an embarrassment for the White House, for the NAACP, a terrible injustice done to a hardworking and principled public servant, that I think this may serve as the moment in which we say, hey, wait a minute, we've got to stand up to this stuff. Every time we step back from it, someone loses and we all lose. It's always better to step to it, to face it, to confront it, and to back it up. And unfortunately, that's what the administration failed to do in this case.
I really appreciate this, Sherilyn. I enjoyed the conversation we had this morning about this. I'm glad you shared it with our listeners. And I want to turn, I said earlier that Dr. Abigail Thunstrom was with us, but she was stuck in traffic. So her collaborator and husband, Dr. Stephen Thunstrom, who's a professor of history at Harvard University, will join us in her stead, which is fine. And Stephen Thunstrom, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You heard what Professor Sherilyn Eifert was just saying.
I heard the tail end of it, yes, and enough at least to have something to disagree with. I think the charge that concern about racial double standards in our society today, racial preferences, is some last gasp of white supremacy is quite ridiculous. There are, I suppose, a handful of white supremacists still around, but the opposition to such preferences is far more widespread. There's a ton of polling data suggesting that at least 80% of whites and about half of blacks and Latinos oppose racial double standards in employment or in admission to higher education. I do agree that Shirley Sherrod got a bad rap. However, I would make 2 points about that. One, the chilling thing about that film clip is that when she was confessing to having earlier in her life, this was a quarter of a century ago, given into a racist impulse while she was being asked for help by a white farmer who was losing his farm, and she felt, you know, blacks are losing their farms, why should I help the white oppressor? And what disturbed me was that the audience there was cheering, seemingly in support of the notion that she should treat blacks and whites differently. It's also striking to me that the NAACP acted so precipitously in disowning her and condemning her because is the argument that, well, this film clip was distorted. It's important to remember the head of the NAACP, Benjamin Jealous, was in the audience. So unless he was taking a nap while this was going on, He knew exactly what she said, and it's certainly curious that he immediately condemned her and then had second thoughts the next day.
Mark,
can I just make one quick correction, because I really want to be clear about this? I didn't say that, and as a matter of fact, I was very clear, and you may have missed this, Dr. Thernstrom, to say that there are legitimate questions to be answered about the concerns of some whites about affirmative action. I talked about the way in which there are some who are using what has been a long-standing discussion about so-called reverse racism since Obama was elected to their ends to be divisive, and it's that I think we have to step to boldly. Secondly, I have viewed carefully the videotape, and it is just not true that the audience cheers at the statement that she was going to treat the white farmer differently. There were several moments of laughter, but they did not cheer. That is a falsehood, and that's why I'm asking people to go and view the videotape for themselves. The only way we can deal with distortions and opinions, including my own, is for people to go to the source. View the videotape yourself.
And I must say that I did watch the videotape myself this morning in its entirety, and I watched the edited version of the tape as well this morning, and I have to concur with the show, and what you're saying is correct. But let me do this. I want to bring other panelists in here and then come back to Dr. Thernstrom. And we have with us Dr. Lester Spence, Dr. Stacey Peterson, and my partner here on the station, often Anthony McCarthy, in the studio. Lester, you've been wanting to say something.
In the interest of time, I'm going to keep my first comments down to two. First is, if Ben Jealous was actually in that audience in 1986 when she gave that speech, if that's what you're implying, Dr. Thernstrom.
No, the speech wasn't in 1986. The event she's talking about, the speech was in June or early July of this year.
Okay, fair enough. So the second piece is that it's interesting. I wanted to thank Dr. your wife, but I want to thank her to you, because she's not with us. Because what she does when she there's another aspect of this dynamic that we're not really talking about, is the way that the right has gone after the new Black Panther Party, as if the new Black Panther Party was the same size and an equivalent of the racist elements in the Tea Party. And the work of your wife was really important from the conservative side in bringing up how that this was just basically a falsehood that the right was trying to use to delegitimize or to further delegitimize the Obama presidency.
Let me ask a question of the panel here. The broader issue to me is the Shirley Sherrod issue is something that kind of brought this to a particular place of exposure, I think. And it made conservatives and liberals and progressives and others who are concerned about these issues to kind of focus on something, because it was so – it didn't take long for the glaring reality that she was being pilloried and crucified unfairly to come to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
And that we saw with that big government blog from Andrew Breitbart, that this was kind of an edited piece that was really went after this hardworking servant who, if you saw the white farmer who she helped, spoke with his wife on television, which I watched this morning as well. I mean, they were very clear. They were aghast that she'd be accused of racism after all she did to help them. And she even talked about how this is an issue of not of race, but of poverty, of class, she was talking about in America, which is important. But having said that, something is going on here, it seems to me, that there has been a reaction to President Barack Obama, whether you support him or not, since he's been president. And part of that reaction is built around race, whether we want to admit it or not. Whether it's what happened with the Tea Party and the signs, whether we want to look at the kind of invective that has gotten popular support from the likes of Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and others who have said some pretty racist and vile things across the airwaves. The speech that's about to happen on the 28th, which is going to cause a symbolic division. It's going to be, I think, there's going to be a crucible of anger and pain in this country around that issue on both sides. But something is going on, and let me posit maybe that part of it has to do with the fact that we won't always have these dialogues about race, but maybe what we are really facing here is a large minority of white Americans. I said a large minority of white Americans who really want to hold on to what they believe deeply as America and what their vision of America is and where they want it to go. And there really is a battleground over the definition of who we are, and part of it has to do with race, and race is a deeply held piece of that. And we have, and so now we're at a place where we're confronting race in a very different way than we ever did before. You know, we went through the fighting segregation, was very blatant, but then things lulled back and forth, affirmative action, the battles around that. But this is, we're in a very different place right now. And I think that this, and I think lines are very clear in this country. Maybe they're not as clear as I think, but I'm thinking they are. And so I like, let's look at that in that from that perspective. And if and I've and we can just go around the room, then we'll open the phones, okay? Because mm-hmm. I know. So, Stephen, how long do you have with us?
I can stay as long as you like.
Perfect. Good. Well, then you can stay the hour.
I'd love to come in on your historical analysis.
No, I'm sure you would. Sheldon, before you have to go, would you like to start very quickly?
Pardon?
Well, you know, Mark, as I've said to you, I'm actually quite hopeful. I think you're right that we're in a moment, but I don't think there's any question about where this moment will end up. There is only one way, and that way is forward. It's not surprising that there are those who are made deeply uncomfortable by the moment that we're in and who feel uncertain about what the future will hold for them. And I think that, you know, there's so many transitions happening in American society right now, and race is but one of them. And we should remember that much of the anxiety that's being experienced by a particular group of people, and by the way, it's not just racial, it's age, it's class, you know, has to do with all of the ways in which those anxieties are playing out. So it has to do with the economy, and it has to do with the kind of work, and it has to do with education. And, you know, I think that to the extent that, you know, we're all made so uncomfortable and so disturbed by what we've seen over the last 2 years, I think it's inevitable. I don't think we can avoid what are the birth pains of the new era that we're preparing to walk into. We're living through the uncomfortable time. I think in the future people will look back and say this was a time in which we entered a new phase. But the entering of that new phase, I think, is deeply, deeply uncomfortable. It's filled with complexity. It's filled with difficulty. It's filled with trying to come to terms with the past and wondering how much of the past bears on what we do today and what we do tomorrow. And it's in the context of that that we're seeing some pretty ugly stuff. And that's why I'm suggesting that the only thing we can do is when we see the ugly, not take two steps backward, take two steps forward and say, that's ugly. That's why I think the NAACP did the right thing in calling on the Tea Party to address racism within its ranks. It wasn't calling the Tea Party racist. It was saying, we've seen the stuff. You need to deal with it. And the funny thing is, this will only help the Tea Party become more legitimate because they will begin to call out racism in their ranks. That's the job of those of us who believe in racial justice and equality. We should call it out. And so that's never comfortable. That's never fun. But that's the moment that we're in.
Let me let Stephen Thernstrom jump in here. Then I want all of you to come into this conversation. Stephen?
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't respond at all to the previous speaker because the quality of the phone connection is such that I couldn't quite make her out. But I did follow you perfectly well. And I would say something is going on. Well, I would say the most important thing going on that you have neglected and that is making race an even touchier subject than it always has been is that a great many Americans, some of whom voted for Obama, are very distressed by the policies he has pursued and are even more distressed because their criticisms about the substance of the medical insurance reform plan and other things are being dismissed as racist. And the Tea Party is being dismissed as somehow dominated by racists. Undoubtedly, there are some people we could call racists who follow the Tea Party. There certainly are black people who could be called racists, who are the followers of Louis Farrakhan, I would say, are certainly suspect in that respect. But I think playing the race card, the Democrats playing of the race card by labeling criticism of the substance of Obama policies and the party the policies of Democrats in Congress, dismissing that as racially motivated or racially tinged, is very bad for the country. Now, I would disagree, by the way, with an earlier comment related to this. I've been engaged in the debate over racial preferences for 25 or 30 years. My wife and I have studied it intensively, have written about it extensively. I don't think it's fair to say there is a deeper popular opposition to such policies today than there was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or 30 years ago. So I don't think concerns over racial preferences have really changed to become more salient or less salient. 10 years ago, many people on the left were worrying about the death of affirmative action. So on that point, I would want to qualify what's been said.
So I'd like to turn to our studio guests here to kind of respond to the major questions we've been talking about. Stacey Peterson, would you like to go ahead, then we'll go to Lester Spence, and of course Anthony McCarthy.
Well, just something that struck me, and particularly as Professor Eiffel was speaking, that it seems as a society we're working very hard to not have this conversation about race and all the dynamics around it. And it's not going to help matters any if we don't, like she's saying, push forward, push ourselves, nudge ourselves. And I'm guilty of it, too, of just sometimes just not wanting to engage in that conversation, or maybe with people who, you know, have a very distinct agenda and really don't want to have a fruitful discussion about it or a civil discussion about it, because a lot of the discourse right now is very, very ugly.
Lester Spence.
Professor Eiffel is exactly right, but where I would push that analysis is that what race does in this new frame, so if you think about race as like kind of a meta idea, that is, it's an idea that shapes other ideas, what this new normal is going to look like is in large part determined, not fully, but partially determined by our ideas about race, right? So if we don't, she's right in that if we don't face this, if we don't take this head on, what's going to happen is that we're going to see race do its work in some way similar to but yet different from the previous era, right? It'll work similar in that it will structure society such that the haves will have more and the have-nots will have less, and those have-nots would tend to be non-white. But it will look different in as much as there's going to be this large swath of Americans who did not think of themselves as being as having race, but it's going to capture them. And I'll give you a quick example. My niece is currently taking a class in Introduction to Bioethics at Hopkins, right? And they're having a discussion about healthcare reform. And one of the students said, I don't think the poor and middle income people should have health care. In fact, I think they'd be better off dead. Now, what was astounding wasn't just that statement, but was the fact that everybody agreed in the class except for my niece and another student. Right. That's the first part that's astounding. The second part is usually we'd only condemn the poor. We only use that language against the poor, who we think of in our head as being black, right? But now there's this large swath of middle-income people, and we see this happening with the unemployed as well, where they're in effect being racialized. The same language that was formerly used primarily against blacks are now used against populations that are predominantly white. And if we don't tackle that head on, then what's going to happen is they're going to end up losing even more than what they've already lost. And then because of the way that demagogues are using the language, they're going to blame that on black people.
And Mark, I'll keep my comments very brief. I know we have a lot of callers that want to join in this conversation. And
calls.
I have the honor of co-hosting with you all the time. So my thoughts on these issues and others are well known to our listeners. But let me say this. Professor Eiffel said something that struck me as very important, that we are at a moment in this country that is ripe for exploitation. And I think we have to look at exploitation in many ways. I think there is an opportunity for progressives and conservatives to begin to have an uncomfortable but honest conversation about race. Too often, Mark, and I heard Dr. Thurmston do it. I've heard Professor Eiffel do it. I have done it. We have a very clear vision in our head about where we are going on the issue of race. Whether we're talking about preferences, whether we're talking about education, whether we're talking about healthcare, we have a dynamic in our brain that really is tilted based on our perspective on these issues of race. And what we are not honest about, oftentimes my perspective on race is colored by, no pun intended, colored by the experiences that I've had in this country. And too often, the rabid right, and I'm not saying Dr. Thurmston represents that, but Glenn Beck having this event on such a hallowed day, not just for African Americans, but for all Americans, sends a message of where we are in this debate. And this idea that that we blanket criticism of healthcare, of preferences and affirmative action, that we color it by saying that any criticism is racist. No. What we must do as progressives is step to those criticisms with facts. That's why I get so excited when I'm with Lester and with Sherilyn and others, because we step to these blanket statements about what Democrats do and progressives do with fact. We can point out racist behavior in the Tea Party movement. But guess what? We also must face that we have racist behavior in the Democratic Party. We have racist behavior in much of the music that our young people listen to. Not only racist, but misogynist and others. So I think progressives and conservatives need to stop playing games, stop with the rhetoric and the talking points from well-paid consultants, and speak truth. Because if we don't learn to speak truth about our experiences and about the public policy that's impacting us every single day, then we fall into this game, Mark. And I also think we have an enormous expectations of this biracial president that he could never, ever meet. From the left, they despise him, Mark. I was at a meeting of gay and lesbian leaders where they tore this president apart, and many of them saying they were not voting for him again. Of course, the verse from the conservatives is well known.
Well, we have to take a break here, and there are so many people calling in. I want to go to the phones here and posit this thing on the way out. That what you said, Anthony, I think that it's very clear that that you can't equate conservatism with racism in America.
Yeah, Mark, can I just say one thing on that?
Very quickly, Sherilyn, we have to go to break.
Well, just in response to what was said before, that, you know, we could have a conversation about health care, about whether we need it, whether or not we should have it. But when Rush Limbaugh says that health care is a form of reparations, see, that's when I think the exploitation happens. When substantive issues, as Lester said, have been racialized in order to avoid having a conversation about the merit.
And what I was going to suggest to you on the way to break was that there are many people who hold racist views who call themselves liberals and progressives in America, and that a large minority of white people in America. I'll just lay this out one more time. I think, and I'm just going to say it's a very dangerous thing to say to people, but a large minority of white people in America are racist. And some of them are also conservative. And there's a large body of people we call in the middle, call independent voters, call them whatever you want, who are largely white, who voted for Barack, many of whom voted for Barack Obama. And since the election and the pain of this country that we have felt since this election, with unemployment, with a fear of your job security, with not knowing if you can take care of your children, not knowing what's going to happen when you become a senior citizen, not knowing if you can retire, and all those other issues, that their anger and fear of that has only been responded to by the Tea Party and the right. And it's a group that can go right or left because it's about their future and not about, because they're non-ideological people. So I'm going to throw that out to all of you when we return from this brief, very brief break. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Women's Health. For every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information at 1-800-492-5538 or www.umm.edu/womencenter. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We have a bevy of callers and a bevy of guests here on the Mark Steiner Show today. Sheila Neifel is a civil rights lawyer and professor of law at the University of Maryland, a contributor to TheRoot.com. Author of The Courthouse Lawn, an incredible book about the last lynching on the Eastern Shore. Dr. Stephen Thernstrom is professor of history at Harvard University. Abigail Thernstrom was scheduled to be on the show. She got stuck in traffic. His wife and they have been collaborators for 25 or 30 years on issues like this. Dr. Stacey Peterson is in the house. She's president of professor of communications arts at the College of Notre Dame. Dr. Lester Spence is professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. And Anthony McCarthy is, of course, host of the Anthony McCarthy Show and co-hosting this show many times. Number here is 410-319-8888 as we are broadcasting here today on WEAA and being filmed for Free Speech TV as we talk. 410-319-8888 is the number here. I do want to raise the issue I raised here, fairly controversial. I'm going to throw it on the table, but let me be fair to my listeners, let a couple of them on the air here for their thoughts. Then let's come back and wrestle with this question about where race and the middle of America fit and what's really going on here. And this is a battle for the middle.
Yes.
And the issue
most
of race
definitely
is at the heart of it, and so is the issue of class.
Yes.
410-319-8888. Michael and Cadence, we've been holding on for the entire show. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing, Mark?
Well, welcome.
Hi, Michael.
How you doing? I just wanted to say one thing. I think that we're living in some sort of alternate universe where up is down, night is day, and somehow a civil rights organization somehow can get labeled as a racist organization by a group of racists in the Tea Party. And how do I know they're racist? I'll tell you how. All you got to do is look on the internet. I mean, you can see pictures. You can go to the NAACP website. They have plenty of pictures on there where people are just making just offensive comments. I saw one of them have looked like a monkey or something that looked like Obama as a puppet or something. I mean, this is how I know that they're racist. Now, I don't know if it's 10% or 90%, but there is an undeniable racist element in this group. And anybody who can't see that and call it what it is just being deliberately dense. Now, this Andrew Breitbart, this guy is a scam artist. Now, basically, when he put this this film on the internet, basically, this was a trap for the NAACP and Obama to see what they would do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they were going to either condemn this woman or if they were going to do nothing, either way, Glenn Beck and the Weasel News Network were going to call them out. Now, basically, they decided to fire this woman, and what did Glenn Beck say? He blamed Obama and administration for, you know, being too quick to fire this woman. You know, they want to give her a second chance. Now, if they didn't do anything, then they would be saying, oh, well, he's a racist because they didn't fire the woman. And basically, what I want to know is where were all of these teabag people at while Bush was running up the deficits? Now, we have to face the fact there are millions of people in this country who have just become completely unhinged in their mind because we have a black president, and they have decided to fix the intelligence around their disingenuous opposition to the federal deficit and big government. You know, where were these people at screaming about, you know, this pointless war in Iraq, who's cost, you know, who knows how many hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, and this the bank bailouts that Bush started, you know, and Bush was the one who did this Medicare prescription drug overhaul. Where were these teabaggers at, crying and whining and screaming about, you know,
okay,
the sky falling?
Michael, I appreciate your call, and let me get another caller in here, then come back to our guests, and who's been holding on equally long, almost, is Courtney. You're on the air. Hi, Courtney, you're on there? You there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I just wanted to speak to the comment was made about Shirley Sherratt, and I believe it was Dr. Thernstrom. I'm pronouncing his name right.
Dr. Thernstrom.
Yes, Thernstrom, the racist impulse. Well, I watched the speech in its entirety, and I think that if anybody watched the speech in its entirety and would see that what she was trying to speak to and what she said when she said that she did just enough to help him, was if you listen to the entire speech, she had no experience helping white farmers because her experience had been with black farmers being the oppressed, black farmers not having any power, black farmers being without. So this was her first experience, and she went through her whole life experience dealing with racial, what went on in her county and when it came to race. She went through a whole life experience showing you that she had no, her whole life experience was white people having the power. This was a shock to her when she had actually helped a white farmer. And what did she do? She got him a white lawyer, and that lawyer didn't do enough for him. So she did go above and beyond, saved his farm, and that's why she told the story to speak to how you mentioned about power and experience, the powerlessness of it, the whole racist impulse. I didn't even hear any undertones of a racist impulse at all, none whatsoever. It was, she was trying to speak to the fact that, again, she had no experience. That was not commonplace for her to see a white person without power, a white person powerless, and another white person trying to take that person's farm away from him. So, again, speaking about the powerlessness of it and putting it into perspective, if you listen to the speech, this is how you said about how it's going to change over time and how race looks differently, it's not going to be blatant. It's not going to be out in the open. So when we start talking, this person's a racist, this person's a racist, some people don't even, because they haven't seen it. You, when you're a black person or you're inflicted upon it or it happens, that's when you know it. And when you spoke about the minority or the handful of white supremacists, don't be fooled. White supremacists aren't stupid. They're not going to come. The ones that really want to do some work, they're not going to come out and say, yeah, I'm a white supremacist. They're going to mask it. They're going to hide it. They're going to be on the defense. I'm a teacher. And the first thing little kids do, if I point out something that you did wrong, well, I'm going to say, well, he did it too. So if I point out, yeah, you lynched my father and I couldn't get a job because I'm this color, well, if we do that, then it's going to be reverse racism. See what happens? So instead of addressing the issue when someone's wrong, they want to point out or manufacture something, like as in this case, which they've done plenty of times. When I say they, whoever you want to call it, whatever conspiracy theory, whoever, politicians, whatever. But it's going to be mass. It's not going to be out and open. It's not going to be blatant. And had it not been for somebody like Shirley Sherrod, who had the life experiences that she had, this might have happened to someone, the person not saying anything. But this particular woman opened her mouth and got on the tallest, highest mountain and said, look, this is what happened to me. It's not right.
Okay,
and just like the people said, you have to face it on. You can't back down. And if more people face it on, like Shirley Sherrod, then maybe what happens, less and less. And that's all I wanted to say.
Courtney, really, Thank you so much for being part of the show today. I appreciate you calling in to the Mark Steiner Show. Thank you. Let's wrestle with some of this in the context of our callers, but also in what I was raising at the middle of the show here before we went to break. And I think that the question is, when things about Shirley Sherrod, this has to do with also what happened to her is also what happened to Acorn when we questioned the congressman on this program when Acorn was being attacked because of those videos. And people who I respect, like Congressman John Sarbanes and others who voted to take the funding away from Acorn, did it without thinking about what these tapes were actually edited, and all the reports have come out now saying Acorn didn't do anything wrong. And so we see another set of edited tapes with Shirley Sherrod. So there's something happening here. I'm going to come back to what I was saying earlier about fighting for the hearts and minds of what I called the middle, especially the middle of white America that's not ideological, and how race plays into that and the fear going on in this country. And it's a perfect storm of all that going on in America right now. And I want to hear your thoughts.
Mark, this is Shirley.
I'd like to comment briefly on the first.
Shirley, let me say, because let Stephen go first, and then you and everybody else jump in. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah. On the first caller, I was somewhat amused to say, you know, just look on the web, and there's all this offensive stuff. Well, did he ever look at the web back when there were cartoons of our first black female Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, portrayed as a little monkey? Did he ever know about all of those monkey dolls labeled George W. Bush? George Bush was called a Hitler probably 50 times as much as Obama has been. So the invective directed against Republicans is certainly, I would say so far, it exceeds anything I've seen directed against Obama.
Though, Dr. Thornton, I would say, ask you this one question, but I kind of want to come back to the point I was trying to ask you all to comment on. But, I mean, there's a difference between someone on the right saying that that Obama is a communist, which has been done over and over again, and a socialist, and and a Stalinist, and somebody looking at George Bush from the left going, he's Hitler, he's a Nazi, he's a fascist, and somebody calling a black person a monkey. They're not the same.
But, well, yeah, but it's all right. Yes, so Condoleezza Rice, that was something done to her by the left. Right?
I never saw that from the left.
I didn't know.
I never saw that from the left, no.
I
never saw that.
Cartoons.
I'm a pretty astute follower of politics. I never saw a racist cartoon coming out of a progressive journal against.
Oh yeah, and for that matter, Colin Powell serving as a Republican was subject to racist cartoons that were not discussed by.
Give us a citation for that, Dr. Thurnstrom.
I think that's nonsense.
I'd have to look it up, obviously.
But let me just bring it back to where we.
With this conversation is that we're using terms that are so broad that they cannot be allocated properly to the question of power. When we talk about the left and the right, who did these cartoons? Who wrote these things? Who said these things? The Tea Party is now an organization that enjoys a House of Representatives caucus, thanks to Michelle Bachmann. Mm-hmm. It is an organization that Republicans flock to for endorsements and are afraid of angering. Republicans are moving to the right in order to forestall the Tea Party. They enjoy their own line on the CNN, C-SPAN political call-in show in the morning. You
their
know,
own
Joe,
television
Joe,
news station.
Joe on the Tea Party line.
Their so, own so, television
so
the news station.
So wait a minute. So the fact that there are always going to be some people who are going to hold up a sign that's terrible or some people who might write something that's terrible, the question is, who are those people? Are they actually able to wield power? Were they invited into Nancy Pelosi's office? Did they have their own phone line, their own separate phone line on the C-SPAN political call-in show? It's not just about whether there are individuals out there saying something. It is about those that we allow to make these kinds of extreme statements. We credit them with power, we kowtow to them, and we, in fact, step back from them, which is the point that I was originally making. And I think it ties to the point you're making, Mark, about this idea of trying to get the middle, because Obama wins the presidency because he's able to capture some independents who say, you know what, give this guy a try. Bush screwed it up so much. Our economy is messed up. We're in these two wars. You know what? I care about my life and my kids' life. I'm willing to give it a try. And in the battle over that middle, we're sometimes willing to pretend that, as one of the callers said, night is day and day is night. You know, there are, you know, Anthony was saying, there are racists on the left and there are racists on the right. Are we saying it's symmetrical? Are we denying
yes.
the history of Dixiecrats in this country who morphed into the modern Republican Party? We can't deny that history. It doesn't mean we talk about it ad nauseum, but we can't pretend that it's all symmetrical. In reaching that middle, I think you're right, Mark. There are people who are genuinely concerned about the economy, about their future, and the Tea Party did speak to them. And I do think that mistakes were made. I said it early on and was vilified for it, that I actually thought that moving ahead with health care reform as the kind of first big initiative was a mistake because most people were concerned about jobs and their homes. People are concerned about being foreclosed and being employed first and foremost, and that it was time to abandon whatever might have been the leftover agenda of the Clinton years or the agenda that Teddy Kennedy had dreamed of, but that instead we needed to be responsive to where Americans were. And so I think you're right that population was not spoken to, and they were instead spoken to by some who speak in that fringe voice. And it's unfortunate. And the question is, can they be returned to, you know, thinking people in the middle who are concerned mostly about moving this country forward?
Now, folks, mentioned that we do, again, have a lot of callers. I want to get back to Dr. Thurnstrom since he's the only conservative in the room today. I want to be fair to him. But let me, Lester, you have something to say here. I want you to let you come in, and then we'll come to Dr. Thurnstrom and to Dr. Peterson over to Anthony. Go ahead.
The point about symmetry is really, really important, right? It's really important because conservatives, with all due respect, like Dr. Thurnstrom, can often make it seem like they're like this. It's both sides, and it's not a matter of both sides. One side wields power, and one side doesn't. The racism that blacks practice is underfunded. It doesn't really work that well. It's like driving a car with two wheels. So real quick, what we have to do to capture that middle is we have to do two things. One is the Obama administration has to be really forceful and not allow themselves to fall victim to the symmetry game, because that's why they tried to fire. That's why they fired Ms. Sherrod in the first place, because they were like, oh, we have a zero discrimination policy. Right. That's why Obama, instead of dealing with the issue of police brutality in a serious way, deals with it with a beer summit. Right. The second thing is that in dealing with race really forthrightly and dealing with the conservative hijacking of the media really forthrightly, he also has to talk to that middle and say, OK, this is what the effect of that narrative is on your preferences. Right. We know that a single payer health care program will be far better for your individual preferences than the ones that you express a desire for. But you express a desire for these policies in part because you think that the state's basically been taken over by black people, for black people. So it's like a two-pronged set of narratives that he has to engage in simultaneously. And yes, it's a tough job, but he chose it.
Stephen, go ahead, and then we'll come over to Stacey.
Yeah, well, I certainly don't think that's a good recipe for Obama's capturing or recapturing the middle. I think Professor Eiffel's comments about perhaps it would have been wise to defer health care and focus on jobs is indeed sound, though I don't think the basic policies of the Obama administration can possibly deliver jobs so long as these policies stifle private investment and discourage entrepreneurial activity. So I think but that's my own ideological perspective. So I don't think if Obama had decided I'll focus on nothing but jobs, what the Democratic Party would do to bring those jobs into existence would probably do more harm than good to employment. But that's my perspective, not shared by other panelists or apparently your listeners. But look, I should get off now. I've enjoyed the conversation, very lively.
I'm glad you've been part of it.
Thank you very much.
And next time you come on or your wife comes on, we'll make sure that it's more evenly balanced on the air. We just have a lot of people in the studio today.
Right. Okay, bye.
Thank you. Thanks. So look, going back to where we were, and Stacey, come in. I mean, I think that there's something here that we've been raising that I want to get your thoughts on. Because you were this question of this where we are in America today. And clearly it seems to me that there is a racist tenor to the opposition that goes on, because I think it exists. It's part of a large minority of people in our country who are holding on to an America that is struggling to survive, and they don't want it to go away. And I don't think that can be converted through dialogue. And I'm curious. I'm asking this question because you're a woman dedicated to dialogue, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about that.
Oh gosh. Well, you know, one of the things that I've been wondering about is how do we deal with the fear element? And it seems like, and Dr. Spence was talking about it, there's this co-opting of the language, of the messages, of the lingo, of the jargon. And it's interesting to me as a African-American woman, a person of color, all those different layers, to listen to media where, you know, privileged, well-to-do white men say that they're being discriminated against and accusing the president of being racist against them. Was it Glenn Beck who said that President Obama didn't like white people? And I was just so fascinated by that, because I'm like, well, what has he done that illustrated that he you know, didn't like white people or anybody else for that matter? So I just don't know how to deal with the fear element that so dominates and just kind of overarches the conversation whenever we're talking about these things. When Anthony was talking about, you know, having, you know, uncomfortable but honest conversation, and I think about, you know, this whole concept, this whole thing going on with Shirley Sherrod and Judge Sotomayor, doesn't a person get an opportunity to express the process that they're going through with their personal development? So when she's telling her story, and when you hear the entire backstory, you're like, wow, and look where she has come and look where she's going to. And if we're really going to have rich conversations about race, we all deserve the opportunity to be able to unpack our backgrounds and our stories and how we got to where we've gotten to or where we're trying to get to.
Excuse me, Sherilyn?
I couldn't agree more. I think that statement is so important, and that's why I've really encouraged people to listen to the video. Mark, you know that I have engaged in many conversations around race, and I'm saying to your viewers that if you will listen to Shirley Sherrod's speech, it is one of the most sensitive, complex, and engaging stories, as Dr. Peterson said, about the journey that someone can go on. And it was fascinating. And it ends with her understanding of class, of
right.
understanding how it really is about those who have versus those who don't have, and that it's not just about race. And she says it's not that she's saying racism doesn't exist, but it really is about power, and that we have to get past just black and white and broaden our understanding to that. Good God. What more do we want from a black woman raised in the county that she was raised in, the South, whose father was killed by whites and so forth? It is an amazing story, and I really encourage your listeners to listen to it themselves.
I absolutely agree. I have listened to it. I was just stunned when I listened to it this morning. Lester, we have about a minute and a half left. I'd like you to close us out, if you would.
I just think it's really fascinating that the Obama administration, given how powerful her speech is, chose to leave her lying there. I mean, I am so disgusted by the fact that the Obama administration didn't take the opportunity to see somebody who represented everything that Obama on paper said he stood for and just left her lying there. If it weren't for the NAACP backtracking, where would she be right now? I mean, she'd have a job definitely somewhere, but we'd be in a far poorer place. He needs to step up.
Closing thought. This is just a little historical closing thought about Ms. Sherrod, that it made me think of Reconstruction, that every time black folks in our country have gotten power, as in Reconstruction, and white folks thought that – white America thought that it was going to be their death knell because they were going to be – it was going to be revenge. The exact opposite has happened in our history, and I think that she showed – a woman of a huge growth, and to go to the pain she's gone through, as Sherilyn Ifill was talking about, and then ending up the place she did, reminded me of the people I lived in Resurrection City with in 1968, who were white and black and poor, who lived together in this one place. So, Sherilyn Ifill, it's always a pleasure and honor to have you with us.
Thanks for including me.
Stacey Peterson.
Thank you.
Great to have you in the studio.
Thank you very
Glad
much.
You're still in Baltimore. Lester Spence, good to have you here.
Hey, good to be here.
And my able companion and co-host, Anthony McCarthy, thank you so much for
sharing
the airwaves. And thank Dr. Stephen Thornstrom for joining us in the midst of the progressives he was stuck with. So the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. When we return, we are going to talk with Tony Gerassi, who is turning around the school system and taking a new job, but turning around the school system in terms of what our children eat, for a fascinating conversation about why our children eat, how they eat, his battles with the bureaucracy in the Baltimore City school system, where he's going next, and the real case he makes about why farmers in Maryland could actually feed people and not work for Monsanto or for Purdue if school systems' budgets were put in their direction. So, very interesting conversation. Stay with us for that. Don't go away.